Let's launch into another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening to Jeremiah chapter 22, where we're going to scroll back and start at verse number 11 to get that context back in place from where we left off on Friday. Jeremiah is prophesying during the kingdom of Jehoiakim, one of the sons of Josiah, who was himself the last good king of southern Judah. All these sons, and apparently a young grandson that is mentioned here, are all evil enough that God only has judgment talk toward them. So Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 11, first talks about the first son of Josiah that succeeded him. And this is what it says: "For thus says he who is concerning Shalom." Now, Shalom is apparently a secondary name for this king. His official name is Jehoahaz. He was the second-born son of Josiah. And when his father was killed at the battle near Megiddo, the people of Jerusalem and Judah decided to put the second-born son on the throne, probably because he was pro-Babylon, or at the very least, he was anti-Egyptian. And it was the Egyptian king Necho that was involved in the death of good king Josiah. So this Shalom, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, who reigned instead of Josiah his father, and who went away to his place, he shall return here no more. But in the place where they'd carried him captive, there shall he die, and he shall never see this land again. So this man was pulled off the throne by agents of King Necho, Pharaoh Necho. He was taken, first of all, north up to an Egyptian base camp. And then, eventually, he is taken by Necho down into Egypt and put into captivity there. And we don't hear anything more about him. And here we are told he won't be back. He will die where he was taken. Woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness, his upper rooms by injustice, who makes his neighbor serve him for nothing and does not give him his wages, who says, "I will build myself a great house with spacious upper rooms," who cuts out windows for it, paneling it with cedar, painting it with vermilion. So this is part of the problem with the people of Judah at this time, is that they're only thinking about themselves, and they take advantage of everybody else. Anybody that has no power gets run roughshod over by those with the power. And so here's somebody building a very expensive house. And God says, "Do you think you're a king because you compete in cedar? Did not your father eat and drink and do justice and righteousness? Then it was well with him. He judged the cause of the poor and the needy, and then it was well." Now, this is true of many of the people in leadership in Jerusalem and Judea at this time, that their predecessors, their family members in the past, we're better people than them. We know this is definitely true of Jehoahaz. His dad was so much better, and he did righteous things. In fact, he's described as being the last great king, the last righteous king of the southern kingdom of Judah. So here is this challenge. Why can't you be, why weren't you like your predecessors, your fathers? Verse number 16, "Is not this to know me, declares he who is?" That is, to judge the poor and the needy properly, fairly. Isn't that how you really get to know me? Verse 17, "But you have eyes and heart only for your dishonest gain, for shedding innocent blood, and for practicing oppression and violence." And so it's because of that self-centered, self-serving attitude that Jehoahaz was taken away to Egypt and will never be back again. And a bunch of the other people of this generation are going to have that same thing happen to them, if they survive at all. Verse 18, therefore, thus says he who is concerning Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. So we've dealt with the second-born son that was the first one to follow dad. Now, God's prophecy through Jeremiah is turned on the firstborn son that served second after his dad. And we have a repeat of a prophecy made earlier. They shall not lament for him, saying, oh, my brother, oh, sister. They shall not lament for him, saying, oh, Lord, oh, his majesty. With the burial of a donkey he shall be buried, dragged and dumped beyond the gates of Jerusalem. So he's not going to get a state funeral. He is going to get the burial of a dead farm animal, basically pulled off to the side of the property and left to rot, or at the very best, maybe buried in a shallow grave. That's all he's going to get. Go up to Lebanon and cry. Lift up your voice in Bashan. Cry out from Abarim, for all your lovers are destroyed. So call out to all the far places around the edges of the Israeli promised land. I spoke to you in your prosperity, but you said, I won't listen. This has been your way from your youth that you've not obeyed my voice. So the people of Israel, Judah, now the last bit of it that's left, and the kings that represent the leadership portion of this kingdom, they just don't listen to God. And really, that's kind of been the way it's been for the majority of the time since God brought them into the promised land. Verse 22, the wind shall shepherd all your shepherds, and your lovers shall go into captivity, and then you will be ashamed and confounded because of all your evil. Now the wind shepherding their shepherds means they're going to be blown away. The leadership, blown away. And even the nations around that they're kind of depending upon, Egypt is one of those big ones now, they're going to be blown away, and trouble is going to fall upon them. Verse 23, O inhabitant of Lebanon, nested among the cedars, how you will be pitied when pangs come upon you, pain as of a woman in labor. Some of the places closer in, like Tyre and Sidon, they also are going to come under the harsh hand of Nebuchadnezzar as he comes as the punishing hand of the Lord into the Middle East. Verse 24. Now we shift to the next person in line for the throne, because we've already read that King Jehoiakim is going to die and won't get a proper burial. His son is the next person in line for the throne, and he's a young man. He will only be 8 years old when his father is taken captive and then dies, and he becomes the new king. But apparently his attitude, his mindset is like his dad's, not like his grandfather, Josiah's. And so he, even at this young age, is showing himself to be an evil person, which is why God won't allow him to reign for any time whatsoever. Verse 24, as I live, declares he who is, though Konia, which is the shortened form of Yaconia, or as we see it in our English Bibles, Jehoiakim. Though Konia, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were the signet ring on my right hand, yet I would tear you off. So the signet ring is the ring that you use to seal up all your official documents. It's a very important ring. And God says, I don't even care if you're the most important thing in Israel, in Judah, at Jerusalem. I don't care if you are the king. I'm ripping you off my metaphorical finger and I'm sticking you off somewhere else. Verse 25, I'll give you into the hand of those who seek your life. Now, they won't kill him, but they do want to grab him. Into the hand of those of whom you are afraid. Now, this is a young man, so he's not muscular. He's not physically capable of fighting whole armies. He can barely take on probably people his own age, let alone an adult. So he is afraid of all this stuff about the Babylonians are coming. The Babylonians are here. They've been here. They're now moving around up in the north. And so he is afraid, and God says through Jeremiah, I'm going to hand you over to the people you're afraid of, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans are just a subgroup of Babylonians. I will hurl you and the mother who bore you into another country where you were not born, and there you shall die. So his mom, when he is declared the new king, becomes kind of the queen mother. And because he's a young man, she should have been the one kind of helping him make good decisions and looking over his shoulder. But guess what? God says, I'm going to take you and your mom and send you far away to a country you were not born in, but that's where you're going to have your grave. That's where you're going to die. Verse 27, but to the land to which they will long to return, there they shall not return. So this guy, Jeconiah, is going to grow up wishing that he could go back to where he was born, but it won't be allowed. He will die in Babylonian exile. Now, his name shows up in the New Testament because his family tree ends up with Joseph of Bethlehem, who then moves up to Nazareth and becomes the adopted father of Jesus. And so in the genealogy in Matthew, Jeconiah is mentioned as being the king whose descendants came back during the returns out of Babylon and then eventually produced this whole genetic line. But that genetic line has a curse put on it where no one anywhere in that line, anyone with this genome in their blood, no one will be allowed to serve as the king, which is, I think, one of the reasons for the virgin birth. Jesus has the legal genetic tree of Solomon all the way up to Jeconiah or Jehoiakim, but not a drop of the blood, because Jesus is descended from Solomon's younger brother, Nathan. And that is the family tree of Mary that you will find in Luke's gospel account. But we're not done with Kenia yet. Verse 28. Is this man Kenia a despised broken pot? A vessel no one cares for? That's rhetorical, yes. Why are he and his children hurled and cast into a land that they do not know? Oh, land, land, land! Hear the word of he who is. Thus says he who is, write this man down as childless. Now, you've got to pay attention here. This is not saying that he won't have kids. It's saying that it won't make a difference in the kingdom chronology. He might as well be childless because none of his descendants will ever sit upon the throne. So write this man down as childless or without a kingly heir, a man who shall not succeed in his days, for none of his offspring shall succeed in sitting on the throne of David and ruling again in Judah. So this, again, I believe, has an awful lot to do with the virgin birth. Chapter 23 of Jeremiah's prophecies continue. Woe to the shepherds who destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture, declares he who is. We are talking about the shepherds being scattered by the wind. The shepherds are the leaders in Judah. And God has got a big problem with them. So woe to them. Verse 2 of chapter 23. Therefore, thus says he who is the God of Israel, concerning the shepherds who care for my people, or should be caring for my people. You have scattered my flock and have driven them away, and you've not attended to them. Behold, I will attend to you for your evil deeds, declares he who is. Then I will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries where I've driven them, and I will bring them back to their fold, and they shall be fruitful and multiply. So God says, regardless of the fact that you guys have been horrible shepherds, rotten shepherds, evil shepherds, I am going to bring back the remnant of my flock out of exile back to this promised land, and I will continue with my work. Verse 4, I will set shepherds over them who will care for them, and they shall fear no more, nor be dismayed, neither shall any be missing, declares he who is. Now, at this point, I believe we've entered into a messianic passage, and even into a millennial passage. Jesus, in John chapter 10, talks about being the good shepherd, caring for the flock. And Peter, when he's writing his pastoral letter, he talks to the shepherds, telling them that they should shepherd the flock of God, because the flock doesn't belong to the leadership of the church. It belongs to Jesus himself. And eventually, as Peter talks about, the chief shepherd shall appear, and all his flock will be handed back into his care, and never again will they be afraid or dismayed, and all of them will be there. They won't be missing. So I think that is a clear reference to the second coming of Jesus, the resurrection of the righteous saints of old, and the living saints of that time period when Jesus returns, and how he will be the eternal King of kings, Lord of lords, and shepherd of those sheep. Verse 5, behold, the days are coming, declares he who is, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch. Now, we've seen this prophecy before about the branch. It refers to this idea that the family, the reigning family of Judah, which would be David's family, is going to be chopped off. That's what's happening with Jehoiakim. He will be the last reigning member of that royal line and is going to be chopped off. And then, at some point in the future, there's going to be this sprig that shoots back up. That's the branch. That's the Messiah. So I'm going to raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. So the very thing that they're not doing in the time of Jeremiah, Jesus will do in the future when he comes. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely. And this is the name by which he will be called, he who is our righteousness. So Jesus is going to save Judah. He's going to save Israel. They're all going to dwell securely in the land, which is going to be the new heaven and the new earth. And Jesus will have this special name of he who is our righteousness. And we know that Jesus is our righteousness. That's what he became on our behalf. He died and gave us our righteousness. He even becomes Melchizedek symbolically, the king of righteousness. Verse 7, therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares he who is, when they shall no longer say, as he who is lives, who brought up the people of the land out of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as he who is lives, who brought up and led the offspring of the house of Israel out of the north country and out of the countries where he'd driven them, then they shall dwell in their own land. So there's going to be a shift from the exodus from Egypt being a really big, important historical event. It'll still be important, but it's going to be shifted, the emphasis, over to the return from the Babylonian and Assyrian exiles. And that's exactly what you see in the time of the New Testament, where it was a big deal that God had brought them back and rebuilt Jerusalem, rebuilt the temple, and reestablished everything in preparation for the coming of the Messiah. Verse number 9. Concerning the prophets, my heart is broken within me. All my bones shake. I'm like a drunken man, like a man overcome by wine, because of he who is and because of his holy words. This seems to be testimony coming from Jeremiah, that he is overwhelmed by all the things he's having to pass on. He's staggered, as we would say, by it. For the land is full of adulterers. Because of the curse, the land mourns, and the pastures of the wilderness are dried up. So the whole place is full of sin. They're cheating on God right and left, as well as cheating on one another. And the land is coming under God's curse. Their course is evil. Their might is not right. Both prophet and priest are ungodly. Even in my house I've found their evil, declares he who is. So it is a shame. And Jeremiah is staggered by it. And he is reflecting the frustration of God himself that it's come to this. Verse 12, therefore, their way shall be to them like slippery paths in the darkness, in which they shall be driven and fall, for I will bring disaster upon them in the year of their punishment, declares he who is. So more of this prophecy of the impending ultimate judgment, the day of the Lord coming against Judah. In the prophets of Samaria, I saw an unsavory thing. So now we have a little throwback, a little flashback to what happened with the judgment of God against the northern kingdom of Israel, the capital city being Samaria. They prophesied by Baal and led my people astray. So that's what got them in trouble. They were worshiping other gods and goddesses. Verse 14, but in the prophets of Jerusalem, I've seen a horrible thing. They commit adultery and walk in lies. They strengthen the hand of evildoers so that no one turns from his evil. So even the leadership, the supposed religious leadership, is involved in this sinful lifestyle. And they help people feel better about their sinful activities. It's a shameful thing. All of them have become like Sodom to me, and its inhabitants like Gomorrah. We've seen this comparison before, that things are so bad in Judah, it's almost Sodom and Gomorrah level. It's certainly far enough down that God is going to bring judgment upon them. Not the ultimate judgment that was against Sodom and Gomorrah, because he also made a promise that there would always be the Israelis, because through them he's going to bring his work to fruition, the bringing of the Messiah and the coming back of the Messiah. But they are very much Sodom and Gomorrah-like. Verse 15, therefore, thus says he who is of the hosts concerning the prophets, behold, I will feed them bitter food and give them poisoned water to drink. For from the prophets of Jerusalem, ungodliness have gone out into all the land. So even the false prophets are going to pay a severe penalty for the part that they played in bringing all of this about. And that should be a heavy warning to preachers today that uphold sinful practices and make excuses for that sort of stuff. Just not appropriate, and God will take account. Thus says he who is of the hosts, do not listen to the words of the prophets who prophesy to you, saying, filling you up with vain hopes, they speak visions of their own minds, not from the mouth of he who is. So they're making it up. They're spinning their own tale for their own purposes. they say continually to those who despise the word of he who is, it shall be well with you. And to everyone who stubbornly follows his own heart, they say, no disaster shall come upon you. Now again, I can't help but think about the New Testament warning that one of the reasons that biblical preaching is needed is because people will eventually get to the point that they will just gather around themselves preachers that will tell them what they want to hear. They'll stick their finger in the air and find out which way the wind is blowing, and that's the way they'll preach. And in this case, they'll be saying, oh, it's good. You're fine. God made you this way. You're good. Or they'll say, no, you don't have to worry about anything. God's not coming down on you. God's a God of love. He never would judge anyone. Well, that's not what the scripture says. Verse 18, for who among them has stood in the counsel of he who is to see and hear his word? Or who has paid attention to his word and listened? In other words, they apparently don't know what they're talking about because they haven't paid attention to what God said. Behold, the storm of the Lord, the storm of he who is, wrath has gone forth, a whirling tempest, and it will burst upon the head of the wicked. The anger of he who is will not turn back until he's executed and accomplished the intents of his heart. In the latter days, you will understand it clearly. So through Jeremiah, there's a God storm coming. There's a day of the Lord storm coming. God's judgment is coming. Verse 21, I did not send the prophets, yet they ran. I did not speak to them, yet they prophesied. But if they had stood in my counsel, if they'd actually paid attention to the message that I was proclaiming, then they would have proclaimed my words to my people, and they would have turned them from their evil way and from the evil of their deeds. So God's message through Jeremiah is, there's a whole bunch of false teachers out there, a whole bunch of false prophets, because if they had paid attention to the actual inspired message, they would be preaching doom and warning you, you need to repent and get right with God.